Okay, so today we want to talk about geodesics in a Schwarzschild space-time. And the idea here is, if we assume that the Schwarzschild solution really defines spherical gravitational systems like what we're in around the Sun, then we're following some geodesics around that. And it should be able to describe the motion of the Earth and the motion of the other planets. And it should do a better job than Newton. So the idea of this part of the chapter is to actually test that out and see if it's true. And one of the problems that kind of motivated relativity and motivated and was solved by general relativity was that when they watched the planet Mercury, it had a precession in its orbit, which couldn't be explained by Newtonian physics. And so one of the things we're going to get to today is actually explaining that. So if you start off with the equation for the Schwarzschild solution, then you calculate all the Christoffel symbol terms first off. And if you do that, you can see that these are all the Christoffel symbol terms that are non-zero, and so there's nine of them. And you can use these in formulating the geodesic equation. So here we have the different geodesic equations, one for time, one for radial space, one for the theta, or direction, and one for phi. And so the idea is, we know from before we've got killing vectors in each of these four directions. We should also be able to have geodesics that should follow in each of these four directions. And so we have the Christoffel symbols. We now have the geodesic equations. And we're going to use the four killing vectors to simplify what we're dealing with. Because if you look at these geodesic equations, the one for time doesn't look too bad, but when you look at the one for radial direction here, this gets pretty complicated. So what we do is we have this killing vector, which is basically simplifies down to taking the killing vector and contracting it with something that looks like the four velocity, and you get a constant. Because, you know, killing vectors are the directions where things are conserved, so if the four velocities moving in that particular direction, it should be constant. And we also have this other term, epsilon, which basically comes from the fact that if you take the four velocities and you do a dot product of them, you're supposed to get a constant, since this term is going to be constant on the geodesic. In other words, it's kind of like you're not accelerating.
And that's a dot product there?
Basically, it's a dot product because you have the metric contracting these two terms,
okay.
Two vectors.
What are the indices on that?
Mu and nu.
Okay. That's on the metric and on the derivative.
Right, right. So these two indices go together, and
okay.
These two indices go together.
Hard to read.
Yeah, sorry about that. Sometime I need to go back and rewrite these on better paper.
Type
them. Yeah.
Did you do yellow paper? Why is it the other ones you did were always clear and didn't have this gray fuzz. What is different?
I think it's actually gray paper.
How could you do that to us?
This wasn't my when I first wrote these. It wasn't my intention to do it like this.
Okay.
So, you know, things. You know, I found myself going through lots and lots of paper and getting paper from everywhere. So it's just one of those things where you do it, you teach it a few times, and then you clean it up. And
okay.
So I'm kind of in that phase right before the cleanup.
Right.
And, you know, in a class like this, you're right, there's a lot of words, so the typing something like this isn't as bad as, like, with Jackson.
Hope you like the equation editor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, if you're really good with Mathematica, you can actually do all this in Mathematica.
And then paste it into Word?
No, actually write,
write the whole thing
with equations and everything in Mathematica. I just got to figure out how to do that sometime.
So, if you have a mass of particles, then this epsilon term is, these other two are going to be four velocity, and the epsilon term is going to be plus one, because these are two time-like vectors. If you have no...
And the metric is mu nu, the indices again.
Right. If you have no trajectories, then what happens is you have the dot product of two null vectors, which is always zero. And so epsilon would be zero. And what you're going to do is you're going to normalize lambda so that for null geodesics, the four momentum is going to be given by this dx mu d lambda. And so what we're basically doing is we have lambda is this affine parameter, which could be like time. And so if you use time invariance, then that implies conservation of energy. If you have spatial invariance, that's going to imply conservation of momentum. And if you have rotational invariance, that's going to be like conservation of angular momentum. So kind of how our conservation laws are going to play into this. So the conservation of angular momentum for a spherically symmetric space implies that you can basically just be right at the equator if you have a single particle. So we can just look at this one plane at the equator and do everything there. And our time-like killing vector looks like this, where it's basically a partial derivative with respect to time in some direction, which ends up giving us just one and the first are zeros. Our angular killing vector, and this is around the phi direction, it's like a partial respect to phi, and you can see that that's just going to give us a one on the phi term. And so when you lower the indice for the killing vectors, you're essentially contracting this with the metric, and that means that you end up getting all these other metric terms involved. And so since we're using just at the equator, theta equals pi over 2, this just becomes the term with just the r squared on it.
Why is it necessarily that the contravariant k has the 1s and the, has the...
I think because, it's kind of a funny thing that, you know, we call the contravariant the vector and the covariant is really just a dual vector. And as long as we're sort of using that definition that that's the vector, then this is the definition of the vector term. It's just that partial derivative thing. So I know it's kind of weird, but it's like saying the contravariant is really the vector and the covariant is just sort of this other thing comes off of it. And actually I found that in like numerical relativity, it's like you've got to define things in terms of what they are, not so you have to actually have your vectors as vectors. And you can't just slip in a covariant and say it's the same thing. So yeah, it's a weird thing that it's stuck with that. Now E is going to be this constant that comes from having the killing vector contracted with this four velocity, and in this case is the time-like killing vector, the four velocity, and so that's. You basically just take this vector here that's written, contract it with four velocity, you get this. And you can see you only have the t term, since only the time-like part of the killing vector exists. And you do the same thing with the rotational. And what happens is, for massless particles, this E is energy. And L... it's angular momentum. If you have a massive particle, then you basically have to... this is per unit mass. So you just divide through by mass, and E becomes energy, and L becomes angular momentum. If you contract the four momentum with the four velocity, then you get the inertial or kinetic energy of the particle. And if you contract the four momentum with the time-like killing vector, you get the total conserved energy. So you can basically, get back to this idea of energy that we normally think of associated with particles in Newtonian physics. And the reason why it's different is because, we have to define what time is and space is and what's the direction of killing vectors in relativity, which we don't have to really worry about in Newtonian physics. Now, the second constant equation that we got implies that epsilon, which is written up here, or an energy is written like this. And so epsilon is really equal to this, because you're summing up the four velocity terms, and you could see that since you can, it's like a dot product, and then you could take each one of these terms, like this term for example, and you could see that that looks a lot like the energy term here. And so you can actually rewrite that as like energy times something, and kind of take your epsilon, which came from this dot product, and rewrite it in terms of conserve things. In which case, you can refocus this. This is basically energy times dt d lambda. And this term here is like the killing vector for rotation, which relates to angular momentum. And so you can rewrite this and say that energy squared gives you all this. And so they kind of folded this together to give you something in terms of energy squared. And you can see the dr d lambda term is out here by itself.
So there's skipped steps, the substitution step, and the dividing through by the 1 minus 2gm over r.
Right.
And then they solve for epsilon?
Mm-hmm. Or solve, basically just moved epsilon by itself.
Epsilon started out by itself.
Yeah, epsilon started off by itself.
I know, but then you have, and then when the arrow is epsilon again, right?
Yeah, because you can look at this as, this here right here is like, this term is literally 1 minus 2gm over r times e squared. And you could do something similar with this term and the L squared. And so what they did was they rewrote this in terms of the conserved quantities. You know, like this is L squared r to the minus 2. So what they did was they did that, and then they just rewrote it to try to put everything in terms of these conserved quantities. And then once you've got this, you basically have the definition of energy here, because you could take energy, E, move it over to the other side, and you've got energy is equal to this kind of velocity squared type term, and then the angular momentum term, and then this epsilon term. Where this epsilon term is actually equal to the same thing as having kind of like something like a potential energy and a kinetic energy.
But Vr is the potential?
Yeah, Vr is like potential. And so what they did was they essentially said that epsilon, let me see, it's actually on page
208 and 209, yeah, is sort of where we are.
Yeah, 208 and 209. And you can see here, yeah, if you look at the bottom of 208, that's where they essentially just tried to rewrite it as, you know, this term with kinetic and potential energy is like what we normally think of as energy. And so this is actually like 1/2 E squared, where this is E, and which implies that the V term from here should be equal to all this other stuff.
Yeah, that was a nice trick.
Yeah. So they kind of did some funny stuff, because this epsilon is different than this epsilon.
Wait a second. That
they're not the same.
They're not the same epsilon?
Right. Yeah, this epsilon basically tells you, are you dealing with matter, massless or massive particles? This epsilon
is equal to plus one.
Yeah. This epsilon is meant to be like energy.
So that's like a script epsilon.
Yeah, it's like a script E.
Energy per unit mass.
Mm-hmm. Energy per unit mass. And you can see that this epsilon, they just related it to this E. Since this is supposed to be like energy, then this should be like
That's still a script E. There's two script E equations.
Yeah, there. The script E is here and here.
And then your next
one. I can write it, put
a little curl at the top. Oh, okay.
There.
And then the other ones on that line are regular E's, epsilons.
Right. These are all, the rest of them are just epsilons. And so if this energy per unit mass is given by this equation, then you could say it's also equal to 1/2 this E squared. And then the kinetic energy part is pretty obvious, because you got a velocity squared term here, velocity squared term here. So, you know, they just basically just put a 1/2 in front of it, and it looks pretty good. The potential then would have to be all the rest of this with the factor of 1/2 in front. And so when you multiply this through, you can see you end up with an epsilon term here. You have this term that comes from having the epsilon times the 2gm over r. When you take out the 2 when you divide it by 1/2. And so that becomes this term. Then you've got the angular momentum term, which multiplies by 1 and gives you this term. And then you have this final cross term with these two, which gives you this third term here. And what happens is the first term is just a constant, which, you know, so this is potential energy here. All this is potential, where this is kinetic energy, which is this term.
And why is the angular momentum part of potential energy?
I'll explain.
Okay.
All right, so you have your constant term and your potential energy. And this is basically, since this is zero for massless particles, and it's one for massive particles. And what this does is it says that if a particle is just there by itself, it already has a gravitational potential energy, or gravitational self-energy to it, which is what you'd expect. The second term goes like gm over r, and you could see that there's an epsilon here. So again, this disappears from massless particles. But from massive particles, it looks just like the Newtonian gravitational potential. Then the next term, which goes like 1 over r squared, is the angular momentum. And what happens, even in Newtonian physics, is that if you solve the Lagrangian in classical mechanics and Newtonian physics for a particle in circular motion, it gives you an angular momentum term just like this. So this exact same term shows up in classical mechanics with Newton, and it dies off as 1 over r squared. And it's because, you know, if you think about it, this is like the centripetal force which balances out the gravitational attraction. And then finally, this last term only comes from general relativity, which goes like 1 over r cubed, and it depends both on the gravitation and the angular momentum. So this is the only term that's really new and that you wouldn't expect. Another thing is that I think there is, this is sort of why it is that you get a different answer from Newton and from Einstein. Because if you take epsilon and you have it equal to 1, this is going to look like Newtonian, this is going to look like Newtonian. The constant you're really not going to notice because you're just looking at potential differences most of the time, but this one is the one that's going to be different.
So in Newtonian, if you have a mass particle, the little 1/2 over epsilon is so small that it doesn't, that term sort of disappears anyway compared to the second term.
Yeah. Yeah. And also another thing, it's a constant. And what happens in Newtonian physics is you're just looking at potential differences or potential gradients.
So if you differentiate it,
then this disappears anyway. So that's all they're saying. And so if you look at this on page 210 and 211, this is basically this is what happens in Newton's world. Is number 2 is typically what you get when you plot the energy of a massive particle. And what happens is you could see that the potential, as you go out to infinity, it drops to 0. But then the competing forces of gravity and angular momentum cause this thing to kind of bow in. Because what happens is the closer you get to the sun, the faster you're spinning, which means the more angular momentum you've got. And so that caused you to have a little dip here and then go up. And so the Earth, for example, would be somewhere in this dip. And what happens is typically the Earth's orbit or some planet's orbit would be right here, which means it can oscillate between being here and here and stay at the same total energy level.
That's that Kepler thing where all the planets are out where they're at mm-hmm. the speed they're at. That's the Kepler difference.
And that also explains why it is planets don't move in perfect circular orbits.
Because they're kind of forced into it by that.
Yeah, and that's why we get these elliptical orbits, because they'll be here sometimes and here other times, and they kind of move back and forth because they're not at the absolute minimum energy here. I mean, they could be at the absolute minimum energy, but it's kind of unlikely it's exactly right here. It's more likely it's going to be here or here and kind of oscillate between the two. And then you'll see that if you get closer and closer, for a massless particle, it doesn't have that angular... It has got the angular momentum part, but it doesn't have that gravitational potential part that causes it to dip down. And so for...
It just goes right up to infinity.
So a beam of light going around the sun just has this angular momentum, which causes it kind of, it wouldn't spin around. It would just basically just shoot right out. But a massive particle like the Earth will kind of spin around in the orbit and bounce around and go in an ellipse because of this. Now, here is the picture for general relativity. Very different. And what happens here is that for a massive particle, if you're far enough out, you actually still see this dip a little bit. Because what happens is, you just have to zoom in on it to see it. But as you go out to infinity, of course, it goes to zero. But then as you come in, it tends to dip down before it goes up. And so you still get that characteristic oscillation. But then as you get to a certain point, it goes up and then it crashes. The crash comes from this last term for general relativity. Because you can see here, there's a minus here, which... the Newtonian part, which caused that dip.
Right.
And then there's the angular momentum part, which caused it to be positive. And so what happens is if you go out to infinity, these terms all disappear. This term disappears first, the GR term, and then the angular momentum term, and then the Newtonian gravity term. But as you get close to the center, what happens is R gets small, so this term gets big, and then this one, and then that one. And since this one is negative, the GR term gets negative, this thing is going to blow up to infinity before these other guys do anything. So in Newtonian physics, for a massless particle, these first two terms are gone. This term doesn't exist, and you just have this little curve which goes up to infinity, positive infinity, at the origin.
That was the left-handed page.
Yeah, that was the left-handed page. But for Einstein, but when you add in mass, you got, you know, the fight between these two terms, which gave you that characteristic dip. For Einstein, as you go into zero, this term dominates. So you go to minus infinity, and it happens whether you're a massive or a massless particle. And then, but if you go out to infinity, this term sort of fades away, and you just get something that looks like Newtonian gravity. So the reason why we didn't notice this in other systems is because typically you're talking about very, very long distances where the general relativity correction doesn't matter. And so what they do a lot of times when they want to simplify a computer code and do a simulation is they might add something called post-Newtonian approximations. And what that means is basically adding on this Einstein term on top of the Newtonian gravity and using that to approximate the solution. So you can see with massive particles, again, looks like Newton out here, but then that GR term gets stronger and stronger and crashes it. And then even for a massless particle, it doesn't have that initial dip because of the Newtonian potential, but it still has that GR term which causes it to crash. And so since that goes down to minus infinity, what happens is that if you're in a strong enough gravitational situation, you get too close, you get sucked in.
Is the suck in, the dip down, is that the black hole part?
Yeah.
So from wherever the dip hits the x-axis, anything to the left of that is black hole?
Kind of. I mean, the best definition of it, of the black hole, is where the escape velocity exceeds the speed of light. So that's how we would actually define the horizon, even though it might seem, you know, if the top speed on your spaceship is, just that of the Voyager, let's say, or the space shuttle, and you're near a black hole, it might as well be the speed of light. Because once you get in, even though you might be up here, it's still going to be more than your engines can overcome. And you could see that they plotted it here for different values of angular momentum.
So someday somebody will go spelunking in black holes like they go in caves, right?
Yeah, they just won't be able to tell you about it.
Well, or they'll have some wormhole. But
yeah.
You have to build a time machine and go back in time to tell you about it.
Yeah.
So what happens here is if the potential goes to zero with respect to R, the derivative of the potential goes to zero with respect to R, then that implies you get circular orbits because basically that means the potential is not changing with R, and so you get a constant for R value.
Is that term number two in that equation?
What?
Would that be term number two in that equation?
Yeah. So basically you take the derivative of this whole thing and set it equal to zero, and where it goes to zero, you got a circular orbit. And so for Newtonian potential, it really only means these two terms, and that's where the two of them balance out, and that only happens at the bottom of your dip. Okay? Now, so if you do this, you can basically get an equation like this. Where what they did was they took the derivative of this potential.
Multiplied through by RC squared.
Multiplied through by RC squared and set it equal to zero. Where this last term here is actually the term that tells you whether you're dealing with Newton or Einstein.
Okay.
And you can see that if you set this last term, this gamma term, equal to zero, it's Newtonian. You don't have the Einstein correction, and you can solve for RC as a function of the angular momentum and the mass of the gravitating object. And you can see that if epsilon is equal to zero for massless particle, then there is no solution, because you know you get angular momentum and this is equal to zero, and that only happens at R equals zero for massless particle for Newton. But for Einstein, what happens is you've got this third term in here, and that complicates how you solve it, because now instead of dealing with just these two terms and you can divide through by RC and you get a trivial solution where for Newton RC equals zero gives you a circular orbit, but then there's another RC value that gives you a circular orbit, which is at the bottom of that dip. For Einstein, now you have a quadratic equation to solve, because you've got RC squared, RC, and nothing. So for Newton, RC is equal to L squared over epsilon GM. And where epsilon equals zero is a massless particle.
That's
and
epsilon, not C?
Yeah, epsilon.
Or case epsilon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry about that. That's right. And so, massless particles are not affected by gravity and can't move in a circle. Massless particles is just basically they just travel around. Massive bound particles move in circles or ellipses, though. And unbound massive particles move in parabolas or hyperbolic shapes. Now you notice as R goes to infinity, you get almost the same answer for Newton and for Einstein. But as R goes to zero, Newtonian physics gives you infinity, and Einstein gives you a potential which goes to zero at some point. And that point where it goes to zero is equal to 2 GM. And so you look at this here. If you take this potential equal to zero, algebraically, you can solve for this. And you can see that, you can literally see that at R equals 2 GM, that's when this potential is going to drop to zero. And so,
oh, great.
Yeah.
So back on these figures here, we have black holes on the right, and
on the right is Einstein's gravity, not necessarily a black hole.
Huh?
Not necessarily a black hole. This is just saying this would even work around our sun or around a neutron star.
Oh.
It's just that this radius, where this potential drops off, is inside the surface of the star, so it doesn't quite match up.
Okay.
It's only because it's a vacuum solution you get to actually go inside of this 2 GM.
So down there where it's going to infinity is 2 GM.
Mm-hmm. And so it should be about 2 GM where that happens. Now, massive particles, what this means is that in Newtonian gravity you have stable orbits, like our sun, moving in a stable orbit around the sun, and so it can go in and out and it's kind of stable around a certain point. In Einstein's gravity you have unstable orbits, where that means that you've always got this extra term, and so you can always kind of fall in to the orbit. Like, you can't really be in a, when you're around a black hole or something like that, eventually you fall in. And so what this means is that for Einstein, you're going to have orbits that are always constantly decaying away. And you could see that they're either going to, according to this, you're either going to fall away from this origin, or you're going to fall into it. You know, it's kind of like how the moon is escaping. Now, if the particle loses enough energy, you know, it can fall in. So it's basically saying that, you know, at some point you can default from a Einstein picture to a Newtonian picture and get a stable orbit or something that looks like a stable orbit, but it's in general, there's going to be unstable orbits that are going to happen. Where if you look at Newton again, like if you look at Newton in picture number 2, even if you're out here, you can kind of fall in and dip back and forth and find yourself in a stable location. For massless particles, according to Newton, massless particles are never going to be trapped. You can, if you have a massless particle like a photon, it can always just keep, it'll just always just keep going. It'll never be trapped by a gravitational field. But for Einstein, if you have a massive enough gravity field, you can actually trap a particle and make it travel in a circle. And that only happens if you get to really small radii.
When you're close to the black hole.
Right. Okay. Now, for general relativity, if you take epsilon equal to 0, you get a massless particle. And the gamma equals 1 also means you're dealing with general relativity. And what you'll find is the stable orbit, or the circular orbit, is going to happen at 3 GM. And this 3 GM represents an unstable radius for a circular orbit of a photon. So in other words, if you take a photon and you're exactly at 3 GM, it'll travel in a circular orbit around the black hole or neutron star or whatever. This actually would work for a neutron star too, by the way. It's, as long as its radius is within 3 GM, it can work. So it may not even completely collapse to a black hole and it'll work. So you do get this stable orbit. And you solve the quadratic, in the case of a massless particle, you can see here that even in general relativity, you're not having to solve a full quadratic equation. You just have these two terms to solve. And so it's pretty easy to solve that. So for a massive particle, what happens is you have to solve this quadratic equation, which means that this thing is a function of angular momentum. And as the angular momentum goes to infinity, what happens is you can approximate solution a little bit. And you can see that this gives you the angular momentum squared plus or minus the angular momentum and then 1 plus all this stuff over L squared. And so the solutions for that, there's two solutions to the quadratic equation, one plus solution, one minus solution. One of them is the 3 GM that we saw before, and the other one is an L squared over 2, or L squared over GM. And this 3 GM is an unstable circular orbit, which is the same orbit that the photon would travel in a circle around. And the other one is the same orbit as Newton would have for a stable orbit. So you get the same result from as you would expect from Newton, as you can see, but here it's it's just only one of two solutions instead of only being the only solution. Now, if you take certain values of the angular momentum, then what you can do is you can plug that in and find out what that gives you for circular orbits. And so you can see here, since this orbit is dependent on angular momentum. And so if L is equal to square root of 12 GM, what that gives you is a case where the two of these end up being the same. And you actually end up having two radii that merge together into one. And so you just have one circular orbit at L squared over 2gm, and that ends up giving you 6gm.
I think radii might have
to. Oh, okay. Well,
we'll check.
I'll have to check that.
It does, but...
Yeah.
I don't know, that doesn't look right.
Yeah, too high.
No, I'm not talking about the spelling, I'm talking about the math.
Oh. Thank you. Of why it came up to 6GM?
Yeah.
Well, check.
That was root 12, and that square is 12, and you're cutting them at 2.
Yeah, because you square it. Page 212 in the book.
Let me see.
The center equations.
Well, nobody's ever reported that as an error.
If you plug in the square root of 12GM for L in the equation above it, you get R equals 12GM over GM. No, 12GM squared over GM.
Yeah, but this is also different.
12GM.
Yeah, but that's different than the 3GM here, too.
Exactly.
So, but, I mean, that's because this is only an approximate as L goes to infinity. I'm pointing the wrong thing. You can see here, as L goes to infinity, that's when this equation involving the square root becomes this one.
Ah, okay.
So this is only an approximation as you go out to very large angular momentum. Here L is much smaller, so you have to take this L and put it into there. Yes. And then you'll see that it comes out to the 6GM. So L goes into infinity, you get the Newtonian solution back, which is what you kind of expect, right? You know, because it's balanced, you know, because it's giving a bigger contribution to the angular momentum term, and then this. But as L equals 12GM, well, that's pretty far from being infinite, and that's why we're getting this two radii merge. And if you go less than 12GM, then what happens is this radical term here becomes imaginary, and in which case you have no solution for the radii. And when that happens, you literally you kind of have to throw up your hands and say, well, it doesn't work. So you can see here that if you put square root of 12GM into this radical,
it goes to zero.
Yeah, gets rid of that, and you just have one solution. And less than that, it's imaginary and no solutions. So that means that at L, if the angular momentum is less than 12 square root of 12GM, there's no stable radii, which means that you fall in. You absolutely can't. If you don't have a certain amount of angular momentum, you're going to just fall into the system. And this is what kind of brings up the term innermost stable circular orbit. So 6GM is the smallest possible stable orbit you can get. ISCO, ISCO. So if you ever hear that referred to, that's where that comes from.
ISCO.
ISCO. Innermost stable circular orbit. So the idea here is we kind of defined how if you take the Einstein solution, you go out to one extreme, you know, L goes to infinity, you get something like Newton. Which makes sense because if you look at the math again, as R goes to infinity, or if L goes really large, if L is really large, then this term is going to dominate. And as R goes to infinity, then this term is going to die away. So as this term dominates, then you get something that's going to kind of balance out these negative terms even better. And that's where you're going to get that dip again, which gives you that Newtonian solution. But, you know, so that works.
This is for a massive particle.
For a massive particle. And then also you could see that if L is large, then these two terms become really large. And these first two terms really don't change because they're so small. And so you end up with something where, you know, even if you have a massless particle, you're still going to get these two terms dominating. And so you get a circular orbit, same as the massless particle. Because these two terms getting large is the same thing as these first two terms shrinking away. So that's how we...
That whole page was on massive particles, correct?
Yeah. Well, yeah, this page that we're on right now.
Well, except for the...
Except for the very top one.
Yeah, that whole discussion there.
Yeah, all that whole discussion was on massive particles. All right, so the next part is basically on how do we know this stuff is true. And this is the one thing, anytime you hear about a physics theory, that you know you have to kind of start questioning whether or not it's true and whether or not the experiments support it. And if they don't, then you know you may not have to go very much further. And so there's three tests that were done on Einstein's general theory of relativity that kind of made it into an accepted theory. One is the deflection of light. The other one is the precession of the perihelion. And the third one is gravitational redshift. And I believe we're going to talk about the first two. The precession and the gravitational redshift. The last two. And I think for the light deflection, I think that's going to have to wait. And actually, I think what they do is the light thing they don't actually get to until Chapter 7 when they talk about the gravity and the weak field regime. So, for the precession of perihelion, the idea here is that the planet Mercury doesn't seem to obey the laws of Newtonian physics. And people noticed this, and it seemed to be a problem, and they checked out the error in their instruments, and they reduced the error, and it still didn't match up. So when Einstein was able to show that you know, he was able to predict it and explain it, then, you know, that was a pretty big accomplishment for the theory. And so the idea is that if you're in a non-circular orbit in general relativity, you're not moving in a perfectly closed ellipse. In Newtonian gravity, you are, but here you're not. And so the way you see this is if you multiply this big epsilon, or the script E, by this d phi d lambda to the minus 2 power equals...
And that's r to the minus 1?
R to the minus...
R to the 4th.
R to the 4th over L squared. Sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah. Do you need to clean these things up? So what this gives us is that dr d phi squared is equal to plus 1 over L squared r to the 4th minus this 2gm over L squared r cubed plus r squared minus 2gmr is equal to 2 epsilon over L cubed r to the 4th. And if you take x equal to L squared over gmr, where x equals 1 is a Newtonian circular orbit, then you can rewrite this thing in terms of x. You know, just an easier variable to keep track of. And you can see now you've got the derivative of x with respect to phi squared, and then you have an angular momentum and gravity term, and then a couple more terms involving x, and then an x cubed term is equal to this.
Oh, can we go back to the top? A precession of perihelia.
Mm-hmm.
Non-circular orbits in general relativity are not perfectly closed ellipses.
Right.
Does that mean they're open ellipses with a little crack in them, or they oscillate between circular and I don't know what that phrase
is. What that means is, like, if you have an ellipse, it goes like this. And it'll always come back on itself. In general relativity, they're saying if the ellipse comes around and then like this.
Oh, it precesses.
It precesses.
Oh, and that's the Mercury precession.
Yeah. And so we're trying to explain why that happens.
Okay.
And so what's really it's going to come down to is d phi. Because if the quarter for the ellipse to precess, then your relationship between phi and the radius is going to have to keep changing. Okay, so you got this written out in terms of x. And now you're going to differentiate with respect to phi. And when you do, you're going to effectively take these two first derivatives and turn it into a second derivative. And then x, let's see. A bunch of these other terms are going to fall out because they're not going to depend on phi, or they're not going to vary with phi. And then x is going to stay because it's going to depend on angular momentum. Yeah, and they basically said x is a function of phi. And so you're differentiating everything with respect to phi. Now, after you've done that, you're going to basically take x and turn it into x naught plus x1, where x naught represents the Newtonian value, and the x1 is going to be a perturbation on that. So it's sort of like you're just taking a perturbation on the Newtonian solution, so you're assuming Newtonian is right, and you're just going to stick close to that. When you do that, what happens is the Newtonian is going to depend on phi. The perturbation is not. So, sorry. Back up.
You got that backwards?
Yeah. Well, what's going to happen is then, well, let's just assume they both depend on phi, since the Newtonian is still turned around with phi. Then what happens is when you split this into two equations, you can first off have the x naught term, where you're taking the derivative with respect to x naught. You got the minus 1, you have the x naught here. And then with this term, is going to be very small for the Newtonian term, so we can kind of get rid of that. And then the for the perturbation term, you've got the derivative with respect to phi, you've got this other term, and you've got the stuff over here. And what they've done is they've sort of split this out into two equations, because instead of having one equation that's really difficult to solve, they have two equations that are a little bit better, where this first equation is meant to be the zeroth order equation because this is exact in x naught. This second equation is a second order equation because these are all the perturbations. And when you take x naught and you square it, it's actually second order because it's going to be pretty small. So this equation, the zeroth order equation, is the exact Newtonian solution. This other equation is the second order solution, which describes the change that you get in order to get to the real solution. And so when you solve the first equation, you get x naught is equal to 1 minus e cosine of phi, which is the same result you'd expect from classical mechanics, where e is known as the eccentricity, and it's made up of the semi-major and semi-minor axes. So this is just a straight classical physics solution.
So that's sort of back to Kepler.
Right. Right. And the second equation here, when you plug in x naught into here, you have the x naught solution from here, then the second order, you get this, and then you can solve which you can solve. And what they did here was they expanded out this solution for x naught. And then after they've expanded it out, they were able to solve it by saying that, well, if we know the derivative of phi d phi, or phi sine phi, is equal to this, and you can see that there is a term here where you have all these cosine phi terms here and a cosine 2 phi there, then they're basically saying, well, if this is what we're going to get over here, then we can kind of assume that we have a solution that's going to give us the cosine term, and then we have this other thing which is going to give us the cosine of 2 phi term in here. And then assume, kind of working backwards, about what this says about the solution. So that when you take a second derivative with respect to phi of the solution, and you add together the solution to it, then this is the solution that would give you that. Does that make any sense? They sort of had to work backwards, in a way, in order to get to it. And so if you take this x1 solution and you take the second derivative with respect to phi, then what you're doing is you're going to take a second derivative of the sine, the phi sine phi term, and the same thing with this other term. And then you're also going to be adding these terms onto them because you're adding x1 onto here. And then the result is going to give you something similar, which is like the result over here with the cosines. So that means that this is going should be the solution for your x sub I. Where here you've got this factor of 3g squared m squared over l squared. And then this first term is basically just a constant. The second term, you could see it grows with phi. So as phi increases, the second term is going to keep increasing. And then this last term is going to oscillate. So as phi changes, it's going to oscillate back and forth. And so x is the sum of basically x naught and x1. And it's going to be something like this, where you could see that this comes from simply taking the solution for x naught, which is just this 1 plus or 1 minus e cosine phi, and then you can kind of ignore the smaller terms. So the eccentricity squared term, this is going to be pretty minor. And so that kind of, you know, falls away. And this other eccentricity squared term is not going to do much. So you can kind of ignore that. And you end up with just a constant times the 3g g squared m squared over l squared, which is going to be pretty small, or especially for high angular momentum. And so the only thing left really is this term. This is going to be the biggest term. And the reason why is because it's going to keep increasing with phi. And so every single orbit you go around, it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger until it's big enough to compete with these other ones. And it only goes like the eccentricity, not eccentricity squared or anything like that. So this is going to be the largest term. And then, and so this is the value of x in terms of everything else. And you can see that you can also write this as if it is just 1 plus the eccentricity times the cosine of this 1 plus 1 minus alpha phi, where alpha is equal to this stuff. And the cosine of 1 minus alpha phi is just equal to this. And so you could see that every time you go around, there's going to be a change in the phi, change in phi. And the change in phi, every time you go 2 pi alpha, is going to be equal to 6 pi g squared m squared over l squared, which is a small number, but it's going to add up over time.
So we have 6 times pi times the g, meaning gravity, times the mass of Mercury squared.
Mass of the sun.
Oh, that's the mass of the sun squared?
Yeah. Yeah, because remember, it's the gravitating mass of the object.
That's the sun. Divided by the angular momentum of Mercury L squared?
Yeah. Planet or the element?
The planet. No, it's, I don't know, it's a little circle with a thing, a typical sign.
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually going to put in the numbers in the next page.
I guess I could put down HG.
Yeah.
No, I meant the planet.
So, what happens is, you could see here that this is basically cosine of phi, but you have this alpha phi term here. And that alpha phi is basically your delta that you're going to get in the angle. And so you just look at every 2 pi, you get this much. So for an ordinary ellipse, the radius is equal to 1 minus the eccentricity squared times A divided by 1 plus epsilon, or sorry, eccentricity cosine of phi. And that gives you an angular momentum.
That's a distance from the sun as a function of that.
Right. And so you get an angular momentum from that, which looks like this. And the angular momentum, you could see, depends on the eccentricity.
And eccentricity is different from each planet, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's Mercury's eccentricity. That
yeah, is. And it depends on the semi-major axis here, A.
Yeah. Oh,
so it's how far out you are is going to determine this. And so when you look at Mercury, since it's very close in, then A is going to be pretty small. And so it makes sense, too, because the further out you are, the more angular momentum you need, because you have to have all that centripetal force to keep you from falling in. So, therefore, if you take this value for L squared and you plug it into here, you can get this as your delta phi. And so the delta phi goes inversely with the distance to the semi-major axis.
Which is why it's more noticeable in Mercury, because it's got a smaller orbit.
Right.
Than the other
right. Smaller orbit means it's going to be more noticeable.
So that's L squared, I think, times the denominator?
I believe
it's
so.
It's not C squared. It can't be. Where you have delta
phi. Oh, no, it is C squared. Because they have to plug in the speed of light in order to get the right units. Okay.
In other words, the delta phi would be like the measure of the second each time.
Right.
The amount of shift that eclipse shifted.
Right. And this is per orbit.
Per orbit.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at it, how it is, this orbit compared to last orbit. And so the Earth should have a precession, and every other planet should.
And why is it because Mercury's so small?
Oh, it's because of the eccentricity.
Is.
Or, I mean, the length of the semi-major axis. And so since the semi-major axis, the bigger the semi-major axis, the bigger the angular momentum. So with Mercury, since it's close in, that means it's going to have a very small angular momentum, and the inverse of this makes it go up. And also you'll notice the more massive the star, the more the more delta phi you're going to see, the more precession.
But in the solar system, mass and sun is the same for all.
Right.
And if eccentricity, if it actually goes to zero, which basically means that you're
circular,
you know, circular, then of course it disappears. But the more elliptical, you're going to see it more.
Oh, wait a minute. Is that our... this isn't our 26,000-year precession, is it? We precess through the equinox.
Oh, I think you're talking about the precession of the...
Well, not the planet.
You're talking about of the solar system?
No, it's the Earth. The Earth precess. I'll think about this.
Yeah.
It must show up somewhere, and this would be very small, and if it's small enough, it could account for the 6,000 years that it takes.
Something like that, yeah. But yeah, because the longer you make it, the slower it's going to process. So the first test is actually to do this with Mercury. And for Mercury, you plug in the numbers, and you have... This is Newton's gravity constant. The mass of the sun divided by c squared is... 1.48 times 10 to the fifth centimeters. Give or take a couple centimeters. The semi-major axis is going to be...
Why is it in terms of centimeters?
Well, it's always going to be in centimeters just to get the same units right.
Because of light?
No, it's just because you want the dimensions to work out. So your solution is going to be dimensionless because it's angle and radians.
And ASTRO, they just default to CGS.
Yeah, and they default to CGS. So the semi-major axis for Mercury is 5.79 times 10 to the 12 centimeters. And it's got a very eccentric orbit of 0.2056. And so we plug all this in, you get a delta phi of 5.01 times 10 to the minus 7 radians per orbit, which is 0.103
minutes
per orbit.
Seconds.
Or seconds. Yeah, sorry, arc seconds per orbit, which is about 43 arc seconds every century.
You should be able to see.
And what's been observed is that you have 5,601 arc seconds per century, because there's a lot of very good astronomical data going back for thousands of years, yeah. And then you can subtract off 5,025 per century because of the geocentric coordinate system we're using. You know, because since they were taking the measurements from Earth, they have to take into account the Earth is rotating about the sun, which changes things. And then you actually get an effect caused by the other planets on Mercury, which is, it's not just spinning around the sun. All these other planets are having a gravitational effect. And that accounts for 532 arc seconds per century, which leaves 44 arc seconds per century they couldn't account for. And that's explained by GR, roughly.
Somebody figured this out?
Yeah.
So I should be able to figure out for the Earth and see how close it is to the...
Something like that, yeah. But, I mean, you also have to take into account the other planets in order for that to work, right? And so, somebody actually had to pour through a lot of astronomical data in order to show this, because it's not... I mean, there's a lot of data, obviously, and it was just a matter of having to pour through it, you know, not the fun part of actually going out and looking through a telescope, but just go through the data and mine it and figure out, do the calculations, and it works. And the person who got to publish that probably had a really good day. All right, so that explains why we have Mercury with this precession. The next part was explaining the redshift, gravitational redshift. So you have a time-like observer, and they basically have a four velocity. The spatial terms are zero, which basically means they're stationary. And if you contract the four velocity with itself, you get minus one. And so you can see then that the zeroth component should be like equal to this, according to using the Schwarzschild solution. So W is going to be given by a contraction of the four velocity with dx d lambda. And this is supposed to represent the frequency of a photon in a null geodesic. Because what happens is we have the four velocity for the observer, and then this other thing can actually represent the photon. And so you're going to contract those two, and you're going to get the frequency that's observed for the photon. And so this is going to come out, since your observer is stationary, then you're only going to want the time part of this, the dt d lambda. And you can pull a term out of that and get that... This should be actually be a minus here. The couldn't see the minus sign with the bar in a way. But that basically is rewritten in terms of energy E. And so this is basically telling you that the frequency observed depends directly on the energy, but then it also has this other component, which is dependent on the space-time. If you take two frequencies and divide one by the other, so you have the frequency of one observer divided by the frequency of the other observer, then it comes out, you lose the energy term because it's the same in both, and you end up with just these two.
That energy is the energy of the photon?
Yeah. And so if you take your radius and you assume that it's much greater than 2 gm, so you're not falling into a black hole, then that simplifies down to 1 minus gm over r1 plus gm over r2, which is basically just the difference in gravitational potential between the two. And so what this tells you then is the frequency is going to decrease as the potential increases, and so you get something called gravitational redshift. Which is sort of like what we talked about before, where we did that little thought experiment where you had the light from the ground and you could show that it was redshifted as it left the gravitational field. Only, and this is basically the same thing. And this was actually measured by Pound and Rebke in 1960. After Einstein died. So they were able to show that you do have this gravitational redshift. And the way they did it was they had gamma rays traveling upwards a distance of 72 feet, which is the height of the physics building at Harvard, and measured the photons at the different levels and saw that it was actually redshifted.
So the frequency decreased as it went up.
Right.
And W is frequency here?
Yeah, W is the frequency. Omega. Or omega is the frequency, like angular frequency.
Oh, that is omega.
Yeah. Let's see W.
Well, the book shows omega.
Yeah. I got to work on my fonts.
Frequency. Yeah. Potential.
And like I said, the only test of Einstein's that wasn't included in this chapter is the one about how the curvature of space-time causes light to deflect. And that, ironically, I think it was actually the first test of Einstein's theory of general relativity. The perihelion thing... when you pass one test, it's good. When you pass all three, it's really impressive. And I think there was a big story about how people had to hike through Antarctica and everything in order to measure that shifting light during a solar eclipse.
Okay.
And during World War I, And so they probably had a huge adventure to do that. The first time they tried to do it, I think some guy forgot the film or something. Messed up. And cameras back then that they were using to take this thing with was like 26 feet long. So they literally had to take each film cartridge and shove it in, take a picture, do the next one. And they had no idea they were even getting pictures. It was really interesting. But
it's not like a Polaroid.
Yeah, not like a Polaroid, not like a, you know, cell phone. Cool, we're done. You know, I mean, it's amazing. Like, to do the science, even though it seemed like a very simple thing, it was actually just so much more involved than, you know, nowadays it's like, okay, hop on a plane and, you know, take a few pictures during an eclipse, come back. You know, don't even need a special camera. So, anyway, that's it for the stuff we're covering today. What we're going to do next time is we're actually going to start talking about Schwarzschild black holes. And I think we're going to be closing off Chapter 5. And then when we get to Chapter 6, that's when we really get into some interesting stuff with the different types of black holes and, you know, actually getting into wormholes and all the stuff that makes science fiction sell. All right, so any questions from today's lecture? Yay, guess not. All right, so I'll see you guys next time.